This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, 25th of March, Tuesday. And is it time for the Democrats to begin using the D word? Jonathan Steele raises this issue over at Huffington Post. I think it's a brilliant insight. He, the reporter, writer for The Guardian in the UK. As we're speaking, John McCain is preparing to give a speech, presumably on the economy. That's how it's being billed. And the economy seems to be the big issue on everybody's mind. But there are some significantly ominous storm clouds on the horizon. And I think that we ignore these at our peril. And this, frankly, is an extraordinary and wonderful opportunity right now to get this out of the way and start painting McCain and the Republicans with the word defeat. Because I guarantee you, when there is a Democratic nominee, you can tell it's getting kind of strange. If there's a Democratic nominee. Anyway, when there's a Democratic nominee, the drumbeat that the Republicans are going to roll out is, they just want to lead us to defeat in Iraq. And so we need a preemptive strike. We need to say, no, in fact, we have already lost Iraq. The defeat in Iraq has already happened. And it has happened as a consequence of Republican policies, explicitly, of the neocon policies that are pursued by John McCain and his neocon buddies. His Project for a New American Century buddies, his Bill Kristol buddies, his George W. Bush and Dick Cheney buddies, that the defeat in Iraq is a done deal. It's over. And in fact, it may be getting worse, and it may be getting worse in some very, very significant ways. Overnight, we have seen some very, very troublesome developments, not just overnight, but over the last couple of days, but in particular overnight. This from the McClatchy newspapers, Lila Fadel and Nancy Youssef, a ceasefire critical to the improved security situation in Iraq appeared to unravel Monday when a militia loyal to radical Shiite Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr began shutting down governments in West Baghdad and issuing demands of the central government. Simultaneously, in the strategic southern port city of Basra, where Sadr's militia, Mahdi militia is in control, the Iraqi government launched a crackdown in the face of warnings by Sadr's followers that they'll fight government forces if any Sadrists are detained. Now, keep in mind, Sadr has himself gone to Iran to study to be a mullah. And so he's over there in Iran right now. His people are saying, enough already of this ceasefire that we've had since August. We're going to start taking this thing back. And they're doing it. I mean, they are really, really doing it. And they're doing it in some pretty spooky and sky. Here's this from Kut from Reuters. Armed followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr seized control of 5 districts in Kut on Tuesday. This is just hours ago. The sources said Sadr's Mehdi army militia were in control of the Jihadi Suhuda. I can't pronounce most of these, but these 5 districts of the city. In Samawa, capital of the southern Mutana province, police imposed a curfew after Mehdi army fighters appeared on the streets. You add to that, then, this Reuters story from this morning, this from the Financial Times, actually, but it originates with Reuters. Iraqi security forces fought fierce gun battles with powerful Shiite militias in Basra on Tuesday, in a major operation aimed at bringing the southern oil city under government control. Keep in mind, Basra is where most of the oil is either produced or shipped. This is the oil center of Iraq. And it's a majority Shiite area. It's in Shiite control, which means, to a large extent, Sadr control. A Reuters witness in the city reported seeing columns of black smoke and hearing explosions of machine gun fire. Television pictures showed Iraqi troops running through empty streets and helicopters flying overhead. The Medi Army, which has thousands of fighters, has kept a relatively low profile since Sadr called a ceasefire last August, but the militia has chafed at the truce, and on Tuesday there were signs that the unrest is spreading. Gunmen and police clashed in Kut, I just told you about that, and in Baghdad's Sadr City. Now, this is 2 million people out of the 5 million people who live in Baghdad live in Sadr City, which is a region of Baghdad, of the city. It's the largest slum in the city, basically. Armed Mahdi fighters had appeared on the streets and ordered Iraqi police and soldiers to get out of the district. Today's Wall Street Journal. Iraqi militias may be preparing to step up attacks. Just consider this. Gina Chan, reporting from Baghdad. Residents in two Shiite-controlled neighborhoods here said armed militias have taken over rooms in several schools and stocked them with rockets in a sign they could be gearing up for more attacks against the U.S.-backed government. Clashes in the south appear to have put Sadr-aligned forces on alert in Baghdad. Armed militia members aligned with Mr. Sadr were walking around Sadr City, Shirtha, and other Shiite districts in Baghdad in what appeared to be a coordinated show of force Monday. That would be yesterday. Some residents are stocking up on food and water. In areas under its control, the Mahdi army ordered some shops to close on Monday. And then they note Mr. Sadr himself has been absent recently from Iraq, studying in Iran to become an Ayatollah. So the defeat word. Oh, well, actually, before I get to that, on top of this, Dick Cheney was in the region. In fact, I think he still is. Was in the region over the weekend. And on Friday of last week, he visited Saudi Arabia. And as Chris Floyd notes over at his blog, chris-floyd.com, he's pointing to an article that was actually reported by the German news service DPA in English that they picked up from the leading newspaper in the Saudi Arabian kingdom, Okaz. Now, Okaz would not be reporting this if it wasn't the will of the rulers of Saudi Arabia. You got this? So this is the major Saudi newspaper laying out this story, saying that the kingdom is now this is the day after Dick Cheney leaves town. He comes into town. He meets with the leaders of Saudi Arabia. The next day, the newspaper tells the people of Saudi Arabia, the leading newspaper, the New York Times of Saudi Arabia, tells the people of Saudi Arabia, quote, that they are preparing national plans to deal with any sudden nuclear and radioactive hazards that may affect the kingdom following experts' warnings of possible attacks on Iran's Bashir nuclear reactors. End of quote. So Cheney comes to town, and the next day, Saudi Arabia goes into get-ready mode, because you look at the U.S. Army, the Pentagon, when they war-gamed this thing, and they just looked at, you know, what would be the consequence of taking out some of these nuclear facilities with these nuclear-tipped bunker buster bombs, which George Bush has already given himself the authority to use. It will take 12 hours from the time he says do it until the bombs hit the ground. He already has the authority. He's already given himself the authority. He's already signed the orders. All he has to do is pick up the phone and say go. And according to this study, this is from the Washington Report, the Washington Post, rather, that The Washington Report, plans for this global strike, which includes a very viable nuclear option, were approved months ago and is now in operation. The planes are already on continuous alert, making nuclear delivery practice runs along the Iranian border. These planes are actually, you know, flying these practice runs along the Iranian border and waiting only for the signal from President George W. Bush to drop their payloads of conventional and nuclear weapons on some 400 targets spread throughout the condemned land. This will be, as Chris Floyd points out, no warning, no declaration of war, no hearings, no public debate. All he has to do is say go. And what will be the result? Well, the National Academy of Sciences, in a study paid for by the Pentagon, said that if they do that, using these nuclear bunker buster bombs, 3 million people will be killed by radiation in just 2 weeks, and 35 million people exposed to dangerous levels of cancer-causing radiation in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Bush has 50 of these weapons at his disposal, by the way. And earlier this week, he pointedly refused to take this option off the table. In fact, he made it a centerpiece of the National Security Strategy of the United States, which was issued last month, the use of these kinds of weapons. The more conservative estimates from the National Academy of Sciences study, if he goes in and uses these weapons, is that 1 million people in Iran will die immediately as a consequence of this. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
No, I don't think so. No, siree, not a bit. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting your local radio station, supporting their sponsors, letting them know you're listening, buying their products, as well as our national sponsors, including the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. So let me summarize this. Here we have the Shiite forces. Keep in mind, Iran is a Shiite country. Saudi Arabia is a Sunni country, by and large. We have the Shiite forces of Muqtada al-Sadr now rising up in the south, in Kut, in Basra, rising up and fighting, major fight with the government. In fact, Nouri al-Maliki, the president of Iraq, is reported to have gone to Basra to oversee the battles. Talking about war breaking out overnight. So we have the, and oddly, he's running basically a Shia government as well. So we have the, you know, a Shia faction against a Shia government on the one hand. At the same time, Dick Cheney traveling around the region, going from country to country, and the day after he goes to Saudi Arabia, they let their people know that they're going on to a let's plan for what might happen if there's nuclear fallout as a consequence of an attack on Iran. And they specifically laid that out. They said, you know, we're not talking about a terrorist bomb going off in Jeddah. We're talking about U.S. nuclear bombs being dropped on Iran. This is what the Saudi press is talking about the day after Dick Cheney was there on Friday. And you look at all, and then on top of that, you get rhetoric like this, which has been repeated 3, 4, 5 times. This is the one where he got corrected by Joe Lieberman. But this is, here's John McCain.
Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and receiving training and are coming back into Iraq from Iran. That's well known. And it's unfortunate.
And then whisper.
I'm sorry. The Iranians are training extremists, not Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, well, actually. And then, you know, he's gone on to say numerous times now, well, in fact, actually, they are training Al-Qaeda. And there is an operational link between Al-Qaeda and Iran, and there was one between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and it's all Al-Qaeda and 9/11. And, you know, Americans don't. Most Americans, they just kind of glaze over. You say Al-Qaeda, and they go, ah! So how do we head this thing off? I mean, if Cy Hirsch is right, if the Saudi newspapers are right, if Dick Cheney is running around the Middle East saying, get ready, because we're going to drop bombs on Iran, nuclear bombs, and if it's going to happen soon, a probable date would probably be April 7th. That'll be the new moon. Or maybe a month from that, or a month from that, or a month from that, or maybe in October in the new moon. Think how that will affect the presidential elections. But if this is going to happen, how do we head it off? I think that Jonathan Steele has a brilliant suggestion in this regard over in his blog over at Huffington Post. He says, let's hold congressional hearings right now on why the United States has experienced a defeat in Iraq. Let's reframe this thing right now out of the surge is working and it's all the military and all that kind of stuff into there's a defeat in Iraq going on right now. How did it happen? How did we lose this? He notes that we started out saying that this occupation of Iraq was important to the war on terror. Well, the reality is that Al-Qaeda has a stronger presence in Iraq now than they never had any presence before. I mean, if somebody from Al-Qaeda showed up in Iraq before Saddam Hussein, I mean, they're competitors. Saddam Hussein would have executed them. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we showed up. Now they've got Disneyland, a training ground. Basic training, 101, right here. Come to Iraq and learn how to fight Americans. Or learn how to fight anybody. Learn how to fight the Saudi royal family. Learn how to fight the Saudi army if the day comes. Number one. Number two, Bush had said that this was going to be this war against Iraq and subsequent occupation was going to be proof positive, a real demonstration of U.S. power in the region, our ability to get things done. Instead, we're looking helpless. We've got 4,000 Americans dead, more than died in 9/11. Depending on the numbers you use and depending on whether you consider things like post-traumatic stress disorder, somewhere between 35,000 and over 100,000 U.S. war casualties, you know, wounded, in addition to the 4,000 dead, 4,000 plus now. Not to mention somewhere between 100,000 and 1 million Iraqis dead. And the second largest refugee crisis in the world, 4.5 million Iraqis, an Iraqi diaspora, both internal and external, 2 million outside the country. I mean, this is an absolute disaster. Congress should be holding hearings on how all these dimensions of the failure of the Bush-McCain policies in Iraq. And if they can bring enough visibility to this, then an attack on Iran will be seen for what it is, an attempt to divert attention.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Strange stuff going on out there in the wire services, as they say. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, who has been accused in recent days of padding her foreign policy resume while First Lady, admitted today that she may have exaggerated after an encounter she had, with Al-Qaeda terror mastermind Osama bin Laden in 1998. In an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Senator Clinton told Tim Russert, quote, I wrestled bin Laden in his cave in 1998 and had him pinned to the ground before the bastard got away. But a review of Senator Clinton's official White House schedule from that period revealed that the then First Lady was nowhere in the vicinity of Mr. bin Laden on that day, but was instead greeting a group of honor roll students at Disney World in Orlando. I may have misspoke about what went on that particular day, Senator Clinton said today, but it was a very busy time for me, what with having that knife fight with Kim Jong-il and all. Reporters peppered Senator Clinton's new press spokesman with questions about another purported exploit of hers, in which the senator claimed that she and a ragtag team of blue-collar drillers deflected an asteroid on a collision course with the Earth. Everything Hillary Clinton says is true, said her new spokesman, the author James Fry. So, thanks to Andy Borowitz to lighten the day up a little bit here. So, but I just want to just recap this very, very quickly, and we'll take your calls and get your thoughts on this. Bush says the war is going to help us. Cheney says, you know, the war is going to help us with oil, for example.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And maybe third or fourth only to Iran, right? So number one is we were supposed to get oil. Number two, it was supposed to pay for itself. Three, we were supposed to be greeted as liberators. Number four, it was supposed to be over in a matter of a few months. And in fact, he declared mission accomplished on May 1st, and the invasion had been in March. So, you know, it's a relatively quick war. The defeats. Al-Qaeda is now in Iraq. It wasn't there before. Bush has been defeated. Bush has lost 4,000 American lives in a display of American force that was supposed to show the world how tough we are and how we can do whatever we want. He has been defeated. Baghdad now has closer links to Tehran than they ever had before. Bush has been defeated. Bush and the neocons said that they were going to create a Western-style democracy in Iraq. Remember that? He has been defeated. And as Jonathan Steele points out over at the Huffington Post, he says, the hearing should be labeled something like the lessons of defeat or the reasons for defeat. Now, why use that word? Because that's the word the Republicans are going to try to pin on the Democrats this fall. And if Cheney is running around the Middle East right now peddling a war with Iran, as Cy Hirsch says he is, and as apparently the Saudi newspaper says he is, then this might be the sort of these public hearings of this type. Public inquiries, public investigations. How did this happen? Let's get Paul Bremer on and have him testify about why he disbanded the army and threw a half million people into unemployment without unemployment insurance. Let's get some of these advisors on to talk about this whole shock doctrine that was practiced in Iraq. This whole day one thing, or year one, year zero thing. The idea of resetting the Iraqi economy, of opening it up to this so-called free trade and globalizing of all the American contractors, all the corruption. You know, the size of government in the United States has increased 3% during the Bush administration. This as a percentage of GDP. It's mind-boggling, from 25 to 28%. And much of it can be tied right back to this. Halliburton. Are the stock price tripled, quadrupled, and now where are they based? Dubai. A defeat for the Bush administration, a defeat for America. How did this happen? I think Jonathan Steele is spot on. So this is a good one. Ernie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Ernie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon.
Thank you.
Tell me this, then. If George Bush can pick up the phone and say, we're going to attack Iran, And literally, you're waging war now against another country who has not done anything to you, has not threatened the United States in any way. You tell me then why Congress then could not remove him and Cheney from office as being incompetent and a danger to national security. And also, how are we going to fight on two fronts? If we're going to fight Iran, what is the Saudi army going to do in Iraq there when they got 60,000 Shiites? Or do you not think they're going to fight?
It is going to turn our soldiers into sitting ducks, our soldiers in Iraq into sitting ducks, first of all. The Shiites, Iraq, even though it had been run by Saddam Hussein, a Sunni, it is a predominantly Shiite country, and the Shiites will rise up, you know, with their, I mean, we will unite two countries that fought a 10-year civil war at the cost of 2 million lives, million on each side. We will unite these two countries in ways that we never could have imagined.
We can't remove him from office?
Well, apparently not. I have been a long and outspoken supporter of impeachment for both these guys, but see, they're not going to do this in a vacuum. There's going to be a drumbeat that's going to lead up to it. And Ernie, thank you for the call, and your point is well made, and I absolutely agree with it. But keep in mind, you got people like John McCain, who now has a 67% national approval rating, because the Democrats are beating each other up rather than beating up McCain. I mean, he's getting away with all these lies in all these different areas because he's got economic cred, and he's got news cred, and he's got war cred, and yeah, right. You got people like John McCain running around saying
Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and receiving training and are coming back into Iraq from Iran. That's well known.
Yeah, yeah. So therefore, take out Iran. I mean, that's how it's going to run. Dave in Granby, Massachusetts, WHMP. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I would take issue with using the word defeat only for this reason, because this administration and the conservatives have been very successful in using our troops as window dressing and set decoration for promoting their policies. And I think the term defeat is too narrow, and it puts too much of the onus on the military. I think the term that should be used is failure, because that expands the scope, and it puts more of the onus on the people who planned the, you know,
it's a good point.
And set things in motion. I think the, you know, they've been successful at just using the military as tools of their policy.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. The phrase that the Republicans are already using for Democrats is defeatists.
But the Democrats are going to have a lot more trouble fighting the term defeat than they are the term failure.
That's why I think that if the Democrats were to attach that term to the Republicans right now, then the Republican attempts to portray the Democrats as defeatist would appear reactive rather than proactive.
Okay. Well, yeah, I see your point. Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, I think it would take away the venom. When the Republicans, you know, right now, when the Republicans say, oh, the Democrats, they're defeatists, they want to lose. And people go, oh. But if you held hearings in Congress and you said, you know, 5 years, how could you call this a success? We're still being shot at. We're still losing people. We're still hemorrhaging, $1 billion, $500 million a day. We're in the middle of a defeat. How did this happen? Let's get some witnesses in here. Let's issue some subpoenas. So that's where I would begin with this. I say to in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, I say to, what's up?
Oh, good morning, Tom. First of all, I'd like to thank you for opening my eyes to what's going on in Saudi Arabia. Had no clue. But no thanks to our American media, which you about Paris Hilton than what's going on in this situation.
Right. This is reported by the German press, actually, first in the Western press.
Okay. Wonderful. Second of all, I wanted to say that this looks like an end for Cheney and Bush not to give up their positions of power, because if they trigger this off late around October or November when elections are supposed to finally be over, then that's a good reason for them to cancel everything and say, oh, well, we're under a national security threat, so let's just go ahead and put this off for a minute and handle this situation because we just nuked some people across the seas.
Well, that would be the clumsy way of doing it. But they may not have to, because it may well be that if they start a nuclear war in the fall of this year, that will cause so many Americans to be so frightened and so freaked out that they will gravitate to the tough military experienced guy, or the perception of that, you know, that would be John McCain, that they will gravitate to the Republican, McCain, the militarist, and say, okay, you know, we're in a war, we need a military. You know, just, I think that it could deliver victory to the Republicans. I mean, this would be an October surprise. They wouldn't need to call off the elections. They'd just put McCain in charge and you know, move through, and then you got the Supreme Court, you know, there's a couple people in there just hanging on, you know, by their fingernails, I suspect. You know, John Paul Stevens, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, even Kennedy's getting fairly old. I don't think that, you know, I hate to contemplate the possibility of canceling.
Yeah, me too. Well, Americans are already paranoid. We're boiling our water. We're protecting ourselves from salmonella. We know we can't eat anything because we're eating poisoned meat because they're feeding us cows that are sick. I mean, come on. There's nothing really going on healthy in this country as it is.
Yeah.
It's just not making the news.
No, you're absolutely right. It's the wonders of Reaganism. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
I say too. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Giving you truth. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Going on 6 years now, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 866-303-2270, our phone number, tomhartman.com, our website, as well as the blogs and everything else over at airamerica.com. Check them both out. Phil in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind?
Hi. I want to give a different perspective to this. You know, if it's raining or snowing in Seattle, and I live in Tampa, Florida, quite honestly, I don't much care. And I think what people do care about in every state of the union is the cost of living and the price of gasoline. I've been working in a Best Buy store for a manufacturer for the last month, and I meet people looking at $2,000 televisions. And, you know, I try to get to know them and before I try to, you know, show them the product, et cetera. And no matter who it is, it seems, and no matter what their age, what people want to talk about is how much they think Bush is an idiot, how much they can't wait until he leaves, and complaining about the price of gasoline.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about a speech that a reverend made 3 years ago. Nobody's talking about the inconsistencies of Hillary Clinton. Nobody's talking about most of this stuff.
Nobody except the TV pundits.
No, I
absolutely agree with you. Nobody's talking about it except the TV pundits. And that's why, you know, for example, yesterday I devoted an hour, I think 2 hours, to economic issues on this program. And we talk about these things regularly. And in fact, let me just put a punctuation mark on it. Phil, thank you for raising the issue. I was talking with my brother Stan, who lives in Michigan, on Sunday, I think, on Sunday, called to wish him and my mom a happy Easter. And he has a number of friends who are truckers, and he said that there's this movement that's spreading across the country of independent truckers talking about shutting down the country. And I mean, there's a lot of buzz about this, and apparently the owner operator independent drivers association, Jim Johnson, the president, has come out and said, you know, let's not strike, this isn't the answer. But then he goes on to say, our federal government is subsidizing railroads, airlines, banks, and farmers. And, you know, we're getting screwed. Those are my words, not his. I mean, he's pointing out the problem. So there are economic issues here. And I think Barack Obama tried to tie the war to the economy last week. But I'm telling you, this is going to get a whole lot bigger, a whole lot faster. And it gets downright spooky when you start dropping nukes on people. Tom in Santa Cruz, California, listening on KXRA. Hey, Tom. That's KRXA.
Oh, yes, KXRA. Hey, Tom. I was listening to your talk about how the Mahdi army is just about ready to explode in various places in Iraq, and I was listening to some videos on an excellent site, the Information Clearinghouse site, a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And these were videos, both of them from the UK Channel 4, and one was another one, and one of them was about how the British literally got driven out of Basra, the city.
Yeah.
Even their own diplomats were saying that in this video.
Mm-hmm.
And the other element is that you talked about how the Mahdi army is going to raise a whole lot of heck. Well, they talked about 80,000 Sunnis that were being paid by the U.S. but weren't being paid. And there's a 30-minute video of these guys, and they're about ready to explode also against the U.S. and the U.S. troops.
Yes, and in fact, you're absolutely right, and this is a major concern right now for a lot of people, is that the Sunnis that we have been paying are not being paid, and they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we want our, you know, I think it's like $10 a week or something we've been paying these guys, and they're saying, you know, we want our checks. Where's the money? And you're absolutely right. That even and that's the thing that has been holding off the Sunnis. And so, A, we arm them, and we pay them, and then we screw up and stop paying them. Apparently, this is some sort of a military snafu. Or it may be that we've been channeling the money through the Shiite government of Sadr. This is the speculation, actually, that I was reading this morning, is that we're channeling that money, that $10 per person per week or whatever it is, through the Shiite government to these Sunni fighters who have been switch sides. You know, they were blowing our vehicles up and killing our guys, and now they're not. And the Al-Maliki government, basically a Shiite government, is going, hey, wait a minute, this is nuts. You know, why are we arming the Sunnis? And this is going to come back and bite us in the butt. So anyhow, Tom, thanks a lot for raising that one too. It's just amazing. Karen in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on 1260 AM. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Tom. I've been listening quite a bit. First of all, there are very few women who get to call into your shows, not just yours, but a lot on Air America.
I think that's the nature of talk radio, that men
I don't
are more
think
likely
so.
To
I held
speak
on
up.
For an hour yesterday to one of your other shows, and one woman got through. But what I want to say is, first of all, nobody's listening to what's going on the television. Nobody's reading what's going on in the press. We do all know that it's male-dominated BS. We don't care about being, you know, our governor being called a Judas or anything else. But what I do know is that the people of the United States are not going to allow two insane people to drop nuclear warheads on any other country at this point, because we don't know who's going to drop them back on us.
Yeah.
Well, Putin has. We are now the enemy.
Yeah, and Putin has implied that he would back up the Iranians in the event that they were attacked.
Oh, I know they will. The Iranians, the Chinese, all the Pakistanis. There are so many others out there with nuclear devices.
But see, I don't think this is going to deter Bush and Cheney. The Washington Post reports that Bush has already given himself this authority, that these planes are already flying. They're just waiting for the order.
That the military higher ups will allow them to take off.
You just had one of them resign over this very
issue.
That's
right. And more will. My brother-in-law was in the Pentagon at one time.
Yeah.
And he doesn't believe that the men who get that high up are that insane.
Karen, I sure hope you're right. I really and truly do. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I appreciate your call, and I sure hope you're right. I pray you're right. 57 minutes past the hour. Should we suggest that Rush Limbaugh be arrested again? Let's discuss that in the next hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Well, let's see. In Ohio, when you register to vote and you designate your party affiliation, you have to certify, under penalty of felony election fraud, and it says so right on the form, that you actually support the party that you are registering to vote with. Welcome back to our program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. It appears that a number of people are not quite doing that. And Limbaugh has been orchestrating this thing, among others, but he's the big one. And this, just from yesterday, I believe.
Operation Chaos is just full speed ahead. But point is here, Bill Clinton can't save her. It's up to us, is the point. Clinton can't save her. Richardson's hale and hearty.
Yeah, and so it's up to the Republicans. Now, this would not be the first time that the Republicans have chosen who they wanted to vote against, or who they wanted to campaign against, rather. Excuse me. You'll remember, you know, back in the day, Nixon did not want to campaign, he knew that he would lose, in fact, to Ed Muskie. And so Colson and others, you know, the dirty tricksters, went off to Vermont and stole some letterhead and wrote this notorious Canuck letter that was published in the Manchester Union Leader, and Ed Muskie, and there are allegations that somebody put LSD or something like it in Muskie's coffee, and he ends up on the back of this flatbed truck blithering about his wife. And it was the end of his candidacy. Nixon sabotaged him, took him down during the primaries. Said, I don't want to run against that guy. That guy will beat me. I want to run against a guy I can beat. And in Michigan, this is, and I, being a Michigander, having grown up there, I remember some of these things. As Coase over at the Daily Coase writes, wrote back in January 10th, he says, in 1972, Republican voters in Michigan decided to make a little mischief. Now, how did they do this? They voted for George Wallace. George Wallace carried the Democratic primaries in 72 in Michigan. Not because the Democrats in Michigan liked George Wallace. It was a huge embarrassment to the Democrats in Michigan. But because the Republicans crossed over and voted in the Democratic primary. A third of all the voters in that Democratic primary were Republicans. In the Democratic primary, voting for George Wallace. In 1988, they did the same thing, and the state went for Jesse Jackson. In 1998, there was a Republican running for governor. I think his name was Baldwin. You know, I haven't lived in the States since 1978, so I don't remember the last Republican governor's name, but it wasn't Baldwin, but something like that. But in any case, he was up for election and wanted to have a weak candidate to run against. And so in the Democratic primaries for the gubernatorial primaries, they got this guy, Jeffrey Feiger, who was the lawyer for Dr. Death, Jack Kevorkian. And the Republicans, again, in 98, they crossed over, and he won the Democratic primary, and so he got to be the guy that the Republicans voted against, you know, or campaigned against. So, you know, Limbaugh trying to get the same thing going on in Ohio, which raises some interesting questions. Just in Cuyahoga County alone, the Plain Dealer says 16,000 Republicans switched parties to vote in the March 4th Democratic primary. And then, as David Edwards and Nick Giuliano write over at The Raw Story, as staggering as the Cuyahoga County figure seemed, exit polls suggest crossover voters may have been even more prevalent elsewhere in the state. So 325,000 voters in the Cleveland area. Statewide, Republicans made up 9% of the Democratic primary electorate. And now it's happening in Pennsylvania. I think that yesterday was the last day for registration in Pennsylvania. But there's been this big push for Republicans to register as Democrats so that they can vote in the Pennsylvania primaries between March 10th and March 17th. 14,000 new Democrats registered to vote, and 29,000 Republicans switched to the Democratic Party. So, for example, back to the Ohio example, this is from the Boston Globe, Scott Hellman writing in the Boston Globe. He's quoting this guy, Kyle Britt, 49 years old. He says, it's as simple as, I don't think McCain can beat Obama if Obama is the Democrat choice. Said Kyle Britt, 49, a Republican leading independent from Huntsville, Texas. Oh, this was in the Texas primary. Who voted for Clinton in the March 4th primary. I do believe Hillary can mobilize enough anti-Clinton people to keep her out of office. Britt said he is certain he will vote for McCain in November. Yet he voted for Clinton in the primary in Texas. About 1,100 miles north in Granville, Ohio, Ben Rader, a 66-year-old retired entrepreneur, said he voted for Clinton in Ohio's primary to further confuse the Democratic race. I'm pretty much tired of the Clintons and see her squirm for 3 or 4 months with Obama beating her up. It's great. It's wonderful, he said. Local Republican activists say stories like these abound in Texas, Ohio, and Mississippi, the three states where the recent surge in Republicans voting for Clinton was evident. And I've shared with you the audio of when I was on Fox and Friends a week or two ago, and 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they were actually it was the Wednesday after the Ohio and Texas primaries, and they said, you know, if you voted for Clinton in the primary but you're actually a Republican and you have no intention of supporting her, call us in, and in 15 minutes they had 800 calls or emails. A staggering 16,000 plus Republicans in Cuyahoga County switched parties. That includes this, by the way, from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, cleveland.com. That includes 931 in Rocky River, 1,027 in Westlake, 1,142 in Strongsville. These are small towns in Ohio. More than a third of the Republicans in Solon and Bay Village switched parties to vote in the Democratic primary. More than a third of all the Republicans in these cities. Pepper Pike, the town of Pepper Pike, had the most dramatic change. Just under half of its Republicans became Democrats for the day. And they wrote on the form that said, under penalty of perjury, you must say that you actually support the principles of the Democratic Party if you're going to change parties. They wrote for things like, for one day only, or I don't believe in abortion. In fact, it turned away at the polls this unprecedented crossover. In that heavily Republican county, officials weren't prepared for the high number of Democratic ballots requested. Some voters waited for more than an hour for the new ballots to be delivered. Others were asked to come back later asked to go to the county board of elections to vote. The reason, a wave of crossover voting in which normally Republican voters ask for Democratic ballots. In Claremont County, turnout surged to 43% Tuesday. This is the Ohio primary, compared with just 31% in the 2004 presidential primary. Of Claremont County's 128,000 registered voters, 37,000 are registered Republicans, 14,000 registered Democrats. How many voted in the Democratic primary? Of those 14,000 registered Democrats, 26,000. More than twice as, almost twice as many. These were Republicans voting as if they were Democrats. Warren County has 12,000 registered Democrats. 27,000 Democratic ballots were cast. And on it goes. So, you know, you check the exit polls. And prior to this organized campaign by Limbaugh and some of these other cons, prior to this organized campaign, Republicans were making up about 9% of the electorate, but they were typically voting for Obama on average. For example, in Wisconsin, it was 72% to 28% for Clinton. In other words, these were Reagan Democrats, Reagan Democrats who had become Republicans. They were really independents, or kind of middle of the road folks who had decided that they like Obama. But in Ohio, the split, instead of being 72-28, as it was in most states prior to this organized campaign by Limbaugh and friends, the split was 49-49. Clinton won the Texas primary by 98,000 votes, and apparently with the delegates with the caucuses that evening, Clinton didn't actually win Texas, but nonetheless won it by 98,000 votes. If the exits are right, 252,000 of those votes were Republicans, and 618,000 were conservatives. So, I mean, they get it. That Limbaugh is right when he says this. You know, that when he goes off on
Operation
his...
Chaos is just full speed ahead. But point is here. Bill Clinton can't save her. It's up to us, is the point. Clinton can't save her. Richardson's hale and hearty.
Yeah, so it's up to the Republicans. Should Rush Limbaugh be indicted for encouraging voter fraud? Interesting question. Or is this just political dirty tricks as usual? See, the First Amendment is still alive and well, and to a large extent, Limbaugh, I suppose, can say whatever he wants, but at least in Ohio, you've got a few tens of thousands and perhaps well over 100,000 people who might face criminal indictment now. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the radio.
Tom Hartman with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Day by day, feeling better and better. Fine thing it is. In fact, this Friday we'll be in Missoula. I'll give you more details on that during the next break. Our program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right and not a privilege. The McClatchy newspapers are announcing an interesting thing, and this is something that I think is really a brilliant suggestion. Although I can argue some downsides to it as well. And that is that after the last primary has been held, which I guess is probably, I don't have the whole schedule and all the dates right in front of me, but I think it's toward the end of May or early June, that the superdelegates, the more or less nearly 800 superdelegates, have their own primary. Get them all together in one room. You know, have a giant primary someplace. Do it in a big city where you can get enough hotel rooms and you can get a ballroom. And have Hillary Clinton come in and give a speech and make her case, and have Barack Obama come in and give a speech and make his case. And then let them vote by secret ballot. Or by public ballot, for that matter. Just say, this is it. We're going to decide now. Because here's the problem. If this thing goes to the convention, if the superdelegates are not asked how they vote, and they're the ones who are going to have to make the decision, because there's no way right now. The only way Barack Obama could get this thing is entirely, I believe, is if he were to just absolutely massively sweep every single state. And there's a few that are going to be tight. And there is going to be a few that may even go to Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton, David Brooks' article in today's New York Times is particularly poignant, and I recommend it to you, even though he is a Republican. Hillary Clinton's, her own people are saying she's got about 5% chance right now. So if at the convention it has not yet been decided and the vote is a floor vote, and you go back to that Carter, you know, when Jimmy Carter was being challenged by Ted Kennedy, you know, the disaster from that. I mean, you will have out of the Republican convention a coronation. You'll have the television footage. Everybody in America will see John McCain coming down the aisle, and everybody's fawning and falling over, and oh, excuse me, isn't he wonderful? And, you know, just blah, blah, blah. And then you go to the Democratic convention, and what's going to happen? You're going to see half the, Hillary Clinton comes out, half the delegates stand up and cheer wildly, half of them are booing. Barack Obama comes out, half the delegates are booing, half of them are cheering wildly. That sucks. I'm sorry. That's lousy television. It's lousy electoral politics. It's incredibly destructive. These superdelegates are going to have to vote. So why not have the vote sooner rather than later? Why not have the vote after all of the states have voted, Guam and Puerto Rico and everything else? And if at that point neither candidate is willing to say, okay, I give, or, you know, good luck to you, then have the superdelegates have their own primary so that at least from June and through July into August when the conventions happen, at least there'll be a few weeks of party unity so that when the nominee shows up at the party, the crowd will go wild, the balloons will sail, and nobody's going to be standing up booing and yelling and saying, no, I like the other guy or the other woman. So I think that's a great idea. In the meantime, what do we do about this very organized campaign by this guy and Limbaugh and others who are on 1,000 radio stations across the country? Not just him. I mean, I think he's on about 600. But you add it all up. I mean, there's hundreds, 300-400 hours a day of conservative talk programming versus the peanut whistle, relatively speaking, of progressive talk programming. And I'm very proud of my audience. I'm live in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York it's all over the country. But it's nothing. Well, it's not nothing. It's not chopped liver, but compared to the, you know, layers. I mean, there are cities that have 3, 4, 5 conservative, you know, talk stations and not even one single progressive talk station, like Atlanta, for example. And in these states, I mean, these guys are driving Republicans to mess with the Democratic primary because they believe, and they truly believe, that if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, then John McCain will win because she'll bring out the anti-Clinton vote. And otherwise, conservatives won't show up at the polls. And why is it the Democrats aren't talking about the fact that the Clinton candidacy is being not just endorsed, but being heavily promoted by Limbaugh and conservatives? And that should cause a few people to scratch their heads, including a few Clinton supporters, you know, who support her on the principles, but may not be considering the politics. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Pain. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful, what is it, Tuesday in the last week of March. David in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, I'm getting better.
That's good. Listen, I have a few issues I want to toss at you. We were talking about Limbaugh and seeing if we can either get this guy arrested or, you know, somehow get him to stop doing this, right? Well, here's a suggestion. Somebody that's in the legal field in your audience needs to go to the United States Code, look under Title 42, Section 1985, and in that particular statute, it delineates a basis for bringing suit against people who, through one form or another, cause subterfuge in elections.
Title 42, Section, say it again?
Section 1985.
Okay.
Okay, now, number two, if anyone is interested, instead of bringing a class action against Limbaugh under that civil statute, they should actually, I would encourage people to file individual suits. That way, he'd have to spread his money around.
So this is a civil statute, so you could sue him for damages, but you could not be prosecuted.
You can get an injunction to keep him from doing this in the future.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now wait now. Now, I'm not sure about this, but Title 18 of the United States Code, Sections 246 and 247, I think that pertains to persons and maybe the government that uses their office or position to defraud persons of their civil rights. And persons who vote supporting their particular party have a right to a fair election, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to appeal to your listeners, both white, black, Hispanic, Native American. If we allow another Republican to take office, I'm sure the 13th Amendment is going to disappear, just like the 4th Amendment disappeared. And if you don't think that these Republicans would somehow, whether by economic means or literally, enslave you, then you got another thought coming. I'd like to talk about
the 13th Amendment, for our listeners who don't know, being the amendment that specifically outlawed slavery.
That's right. But, you know, what I'm saying is, these crazy Republicans will do anything to take power away from you and suppress you and lock you up somewhere.
Yeah, you know, I would suggest to you that they don't need to do away with the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime where the party has been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States. And when you've got, 10% of the African-American population having been being in the criminal justice system, I would submit to you that they are using this loophole in the 13th Amendment basically to reinstate slavery.
Right. Well, but I'm saying that amendment, I would think that people would want to hold on to that amendment because without it, what basis would whites and other persons have for not being enslaved?
Now, right. Who will soon be the minority?
Let me talk about Hillary.
Sure.
Hillary flat out lied. I don't care if they window dress it, sugarcoat it. She said that she had to duck her head in reference to sniper fire. That's what she said. Now, let me talk about Obama. I disagree with you when you say that Obama would have to sweep the rest of the states. He's in the lead.
In order to get enough numerical delegates to hit that 20, I think it's 2026, whatever that threshold is.
Mm-hmm.
All of the analysis that I'm seeing is that neither one of them are actually going, that it's virtually impossible and perhaps absolutely impossible for either one of them to get all that, to surpass that threshold the way the McCain did in the Republican primaries last week. It is going to require the votes of some of the superdelegates to make it happen.
Well, I would just hope and pray that this thing turns out where the party is united, and the best person is set in office. One more thing. Rendell, Governor Rendell here in the state of Pennsylvania, flatly said, well, whites are not going to vote for a black man. Well, I just want Governor Rendell.
I would refer him to the state of Wisconsin and the state of Utah, or Iowa,
well,
rather.
I just want him to know that there's a lot of African Americans in this state that voted for him to become governor. When he tries another office, believe me, we won't be there. And if he thinks he's going to make the county executive, Dan Honorato, governor, we're not going to be there. So if you think that you did us a favor, Mr. Rendell, by making those statements, you'll see in November.
Yeah, that was.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, David. Yeah, is rather gratuitous statements. Well said, David. Mike in Queens, New York. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom,
WWRL.
Great show. This is a great show.
Thank you.
I like what that guy said before about, you know, all those losses, but this is what also we can do to Rush. You know how the Republicans in Congress and the Senate scream about election fraud?
Oh, it's their,
Let's
you know, they're hysterical
Rush
about
Limbaugh
it.
And all his buddies before Congress and just grill them for like a week or two.
About election fraud.
About election fraud.
Yeah. See, what you're going to get back is, hey, you know, we've got the First Amendment in the United States. I can say anything I want. I'm just an entertainer, blah, 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 blah. And there actually may be some truth to that. The problem is that he is encouraging people to commit what, at least in Ohio, is a crime. And I believe that encouraging people to commit crimes is itself a crime, although I'm not representing myself as an attorney here. But, you know, it presents a whole series of interesting questions. But Mike, your suggestion that they pull them before Congress and say, okay, guys, let's talk about this. Very interesting. Robin in San Rafael, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Tom. I know you were out of the country last week, but Obama was running a video on his website for at least 2 weeks telling Republicans they could become Democrats for a day and vote in Pennsylvania. And he's been doing this in Nevada. He did it in Texas. Don't not blame this on Rush Limbaugh. You know, the media is actually, I think, pushing Obama because they think he will be the...
Obama's campaign was, if you support me, and if you intend to vote for me, then you can help me become the candidate by becoming a Democrat for a day.
No, Tom, he's telling them, you know, you can switch for a day. And also,
not to screw up the Democratic primary, though. It's a completely different thing.
Why is Obama against revoting in Michigan and Florida? Because
he's not against it.
He is against it.
He has not come out against it. He has not taken a position on it.
He's blocked it in Michigan.
To the best of my knowledge, you're wrong.
You were not here last week. He blocked it in Michigan. It was ready to go, and he is against it because you know why? Because Hillary and Obama are separated by about 1% of delegates and votes. If those people get to vote, and the polls show Obama will lose, and he is disenfranchising over 2 million voters. And I am so sick of everybody saying Hillary's running a negative campaign, Obama's pure as a driven snow. He is not. It's his campaign.
So how does Hillary Clinton win right now?
Because if Obama says that people, the superdelegates should follow the will of the people, then he's going to lose Kennedy, Kerry, Deval Patrick, Richardson. All of those people's states voted for Hillary.
So your suggestion then is that the superdelegates...
That's what he's suggesting.
Fine. So you're suggesting that... But what you're saying is that the way that... I ask you the question, how does Hillary Clinton win this election?
Then the superdelegates are going to have to decide one way or the other. Neither one of these candidates can win the regular popular vote or without the superdelegates.
No,
neither one.
I agree with you, Robin. Thank you for your comments. I refer you to David Brooks' piece today, The Long Defeat, where he talks about, in short, you know, Hillary Clinton has, according to her people, you know, Clinton advisor Jim Vandehei and Mike Allen, also political, that Clinton has about a 10% chance of getting the nomination. Now she's probably down to about 5%. And is that, what kind of damage is that going to do to the party to carry this forward? Now, I'm not suggesting that she should pull out. I would like to see her run a positive campaign. I'd like to see Obama run a positive campaign. As I said yesterday, when Obama came here to Portland and he gave a brilliant speech, I five different times, John Edwards, earlier on in the campaign, gave speeches that so moved me that I went to his website and I gave him money. I gave money to Dennis Kucinich. And when Obama came to town, he gave a speech, and I was so moved by that speech, I watched the whole thing on television, that I went to his website and I gave him some money. I gave him $100. And I am waiting for Hillary Clinton to do the same thing. And I'm right here willing to send money to her campaign if she can inspire me the way that he inspired me. So, and I'm not saying that she can't. I'm absolutely not. Daryl in New York. Hey, Daryl, I've got about a half a minute. Actually, Daryl, let me put you back on hold here because we've got about 15 seconds, and we'll pick it up on the other side. But this is the bottom line here is I think that David Brooks has nailed it down well, and that is that this is going to be a really tough one for this party. And it seems to me that the solution, and I just want to say it one more time, is for the superdelegates to have their own convention after all of the people have spoken. And Hillary can come forward and say, hey, you know, if your state voted for me, then you shouldn't vote for Obama. And Obama can come forward and say whatever his pitch is. Hey, I got more votes or more delegates or whatever. And let them vote. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
And a half minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right and not a privilege. Daryl in New York, I so rudely cut you off before we went to the break. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you so much for holding me over. I'm in New York. I'm an African-American man. I'm a Hillary supporter. I think that Republicans need to be careful what they wish for. I remember when she was running for Senate that Republicans couldn't wait to run against her.
But they didn't throw up a serious candidate against her. I mean, there was talk about Giuliani running against her, but the guy that ended up running against her never polled any consequence. I mean, not unlike, and, you know, let's just be candid about this, not unlike Barack Obama running against Alan Keyes.
I think that there's some truth to that, but she was even polling well against Giuliani before he dropped out. I think what happens with Republicans, I mean, we've got a Democratic former governor in jail right now in Alabama because he won. Because he beat Republicans and they couldn't stand it. That's why.
He's in jail because he's in jail because they stole the election from him and he pointed it out.
Republicans hate, especially they hate Southern white Democrats.
Yeah.
Who beat them? They hate them, and that's one of the reasons why they hate the Clintons so much. And just one more real quick thing: your previous caller was absolutely right. Although Barack Obama publicly has sort of maintained his neutrality on the subject of the revote in Florida and Michigan, his surrogates in the Democratic Party in those states have been absolutely opposed to it. You know, so that's one of the ways he's sort of keeping his hands clean on the issue. The last thing I just wanted to say is the first time I listened to your show, I turned it on, I heard a Republican speaking, and I was like, what the hell is this? This is Air America Radio. And I listened, and over the weeks, I was, wow, he's speaking to Republicans, he's engaging them, and he's being respectful of their opinions while fighting them tooth and nail. And, you know, you kind of won me over. That's what we need. That's the type
of
thing we need.
Thank you, Daryl. Thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it. And thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you today. And if your candidate wins, I'm there with her. Mike Capuano is with us. He is the congressman from Massachusetts, the 8th District of Massachusetts, and also the co-chair of the Sudan Caucus. And I just returned from Sudan on Wednesday of last week. And Congressman, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Tell us your assessment of the situation in Darfur, in West and North Sudan, and in South Sudan, where this refugee crisis is going on.
I'm actually glad you brought in the South Sudan. A lot of people forget there's a problem down there as well. I personally think that the whole situation is slowly unraveling, maybe quickly unraveling, depending on which news report you listen to. You've been there more recently than I have. And I think that there is a real danger both to the people of Darfur and to the peace of the entire region unless the government in Khartoum starts listening to international pressure, which also would require international pressure to increase.
Yeah, we spent about an hour with Salva Kiir, the president of South Sudan and the vice president of both. And I beg your pardon?
Yes, he's a good man.
And yeah, I was just a really he is more articulate and more thoughtful in his speaking than most American politicians, frankly. and
he doesn't have to worry about the media.
Yeah, perhaps. But you know, I asked him just, you know, point blank, what's China's role in all this, and what's you know, what's your take on the future of this, and what about the government in Khartoum moving borders and things as a consequence of oil being discovered in the south? And I'm still slicing and dicing the audio tape. I'm going to share it with my listeners next week. Hopefully, I'll be able to get it done this weekend. But the sense that I got, I can't quote his words, I don't have them in front of me, but the sense that I got is that they are very reluctantly and with great horror preparing for another civil war.
I think that's a fair assessment from what I know.
So what can we do as Americans?
America has done a fair amount there. I mean, I would argue that the Bush administration could do more. I'm one of the, to my knowledge, the only person who's actually called for U.S. troops to go on the ground in Darfur. I'm not a militaristic person, but I think stopping a genocide is a moral issue that circumvents any international concerns I might have.
I agree.
On the south part of it, it's a little different issue. I really think that the only country in the world, and the only major country in the world, that has any impact whatsoever on Khartoum is China. And it's because of their trade policies, because China is basically underwriting all of their oil exploration and lots of different reasons. And I really believe that the only way to get them to change their policies, and I don't mean change, I'm not looking for them to become the greatest people in the world, just stop a massacre and get back to the table to negotiate the peace in the south, is through pressure from the international community, from the United Nations, from NATO, particularly from China. Until this point, though China has done a few things that have gone in the right direction, they have also acted as their protector at the UN by vetoing and certain actions that I think are necessary.
Right.
And I think that we have the best opportunity ever in the Olympics to make that point.
Yeah, China, you know, they have a culture that values face very highly. You know, shame is a greater or more horrible emotion to the Chinese than being guilty of sin, for example, which would be the horrible emotion in our culture. And so if we can use the threat of the loss of face, I think Steven Spielberg, you know,
he helped a lot.
Yeah. And but it seems to have dropped back below the radar now, and I don't think most Americans realize the role that China is playing in this. And what if the United States was to exempt South Sudan from the ban on oil exports?
It would be very easy. I mean, South Sudan hasn't got access to much oil just yet. That's the whole debate at the moment, but certainly there are things we can do that would further push this issue. But the truth is, and it's not just a Sudanese issue. I want to make that clear. It is Sudanese who are dying in Darfur, but the whole region runs the risk of a major military conflict. We just saw one not too long ago. It spilled over into the borders of Chad.
Right.
It spilled over into the borders of Somalia. It spilled over into the borders of Ethiopia. And, yeah. You know,
and if this spilled over into Kenya, it would be a real mess.
Real mess.
Congressman Mike Capuano of Massachusetts, sir, thanks for the great work you're doing.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for being with us. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative
con.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
So are we approaching a perfect storm in the Middle East, in Iraq specifically, and the region around Iraq and Iran and others? I'm reading from the German press agency, translated into English, DPA, one of the German press agencies, Dateline Riyadh. This is the day after Dick Cheney was in Saudi Arabia. This was last Friday. On Saturday, the German press agency offers a translation of an article in the Saudi newspapers. Here's the article. The Saudi Shura Council will secretly discuss national plans to deal with any sudden nuclear and radioactive hazards that may affect the kingdom following experts' warnings of possible attacks on Iran's Bushehr nuclear reactors. And then the German press agency adds media reports said Saturday. Now back to the German agency. The Saudi-based King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology has prepared a proposal that encapsulates the probabilities of leaking nuclear and radiation hazards in case of any unexpected nuclear attacks in Iran. The OCAS Saudi newspaper said. The Saudi Shura, or Consultative Council, plans to debate the proposal on Sunday. The power plants in southwestern Iran, port of Bushehr, were built with German assistance in 1974 and resumed with Russian aid in 1992 after it had been stopped by the Islamic Revolution. That's the entire article. So we have John McCain out there saying things like, everybody knows that Iran is...
Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and receiving training and are coming back into Iraq from Iran. That's well known.
So is this a setup? And at the same time, we have now the Mahdi army starting to push back. It looks like the South is starting to melt down. And Muqtada al-Sadr, I believe, is still in Iran studying to become a mullah. So let's ask a real expert on the region, Dar Jamil. Dar Jamil, his absolutely brilliant book, Beyond the Green Zone. His website, Dar Jamil, DarJamail, Iraq, IRAQ.com. Dar Jamil, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Great to have you back on the program here with us, Dar. Can you tell us your take on this seemingly relatively sudden confluence of events that I just laid out, of Cheney going to Saudi Arabia, the next day Saudi Arabia talking about preparing for the possibility of nuclear fallout in the region as a result of an attack on Iran with nuclear bunker buster bombs, plus the breakdown of the, or the apparent breakdown of this truce that Sadr had called, plus is Sadr still inside or outside the country? I mean, what's going on over there?
Well, it certainly is all interrelated. I'll take it a bit haphazardly, because starting with Iraq, because for a long time now there's been efforts by the U.S.-backed Maliki government to go after Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, going after it in certain areas like Kut and down in Basra, and certainly in areas like Sadr City and Baghdad, to try to kind of keep it in check and I think even diminish some of its capacities to respond if and when an attack against Iran is to take place. Because, and I'm sure you recall, Tom, it was not that long ago, I think about a year or so ago, where Muqtada al-Sadr from Tehran announced that any attack on Iran would be considered as an attack on him and all of his followers in the Sadr movement, which are millions of people.
Right, so suddenly all of our soldiers are sitting ducks in Iraq.
Essentially, yes. I mean, southern Iraq is already really largely out of control of all occupation forces, and really what we see now of the Muqtada, the militia of Muqtada al-Sadr is really pushing back and saying, look, you're not going to keep detaining our people, you're not going to keep chipping away at our power, and if you keep doing it, then you're going to have a real fight on your hands right now.
But southern Iraq is where all the oil is, not necessarily all the oil is drilled, but it's certainly the area through which all the oil passes, or the majority of it, if my understanding is correct, of the geography of the region. That being the case, is this a battle over resources?
Partly, yes. I mean, there's been an ongoing struggle between Muqtada al-Sadr, between the SAIC group and the government and the Al-Fadila party for control over southern Iraq. I mean, various cities on any given day are going to be in more control of one of those three groups than the other, and then maybe the next day it's going to be completely different. And that's been how volatile and changing the situation has been now for well over a year, and that's the situation today. And it is looking like, I think this is certainly tied into that struggle, where we certainly have basically the government trying to take control over the part south, and that is, of course, where the largest oil reserves in the country are. But it's also important that forces loyal to occupation forces are in control of it, because if and when an attack on Iran takes place, whether it's carried out by the U.S. or Israel or both, one thing we have to keep in mind, and Seymour Hersh has pointed this out in some of his articles, the main umbilical cord, the ground umbilical cord of supply for the U.S. occupation of Iraq goes directly from northern Kuwait to Baghdad. We have to keep in mind that the top third of northern Kuwait, granted this is not a large country at all, but the top third of that country is completely occupied by the U.S. because that's where all of the supplies are then loaded up, put on trucks, and then shipped in armed convoys up through southern Iraq, up into Baghdad, and dispersed to bases from there. So one of the likely scenarios pointed out by CIA members is that that pipeline for supplies will essentially be cut. U.S. military personnel in Iraq will likely be targeted and many other things. So it's no coincidence whatsoever that McCain and Cheney are both over in the Middle East recently. Condoleezza Rice herself, in addition to that, talking with various Arab and non-Arab leaders, I think in preparation for what may well come, obviously, before this administration leaves power.
Would the attacking of Iran be a political and desperate move on the part of the United States? And obviously, it would be provocative. Or would it be perhaps I can't imagine why, but a wise move on the part of the United States. I mean, what's their rationale? Why are they not trying to get us out and get the Arab League in, for example?
Well, God only knows what goes on in these people's minds. I mean, obviously, it's absolute lunacy to launch an attack against Iran, particularly at this moment where not only in Iraq do we have Muqtada al-Sadr's militia effectively off stand down at this point, where really we are one or two incidents away from all-out war, again, with Muqtada al-Sadr's militia against occupation forces, in addition to, excuse me, in addition to the awakening forces. We already have several of these groups are now on strike, many of them already in open combat against government forces, and some of them now going back into combat.
Right. Now, that's because they're not being paid, and is that because the payments are being channeled through the Maliki government, the Shiite government, which is now starting to get very reluctant to keep handing money to Sunni militias?
That's a big part of it, because the Maliki government's been opposed to having the awakening forces formed from the very beginning. This is where it's very clear where U.S. policy, rather than bringing anything like a situation where reconciliation might be closer in Iraq, they've really caused the opposite, where reconciliation is so much further away than it was today. It's further away than it was even before the so-called surge was launched. And that's in large part because of forming these awakening groups, despite Maliki government opposition to them, funding them, despite Maliki government opposition to them. And now these groups are, of course, demanding government pay and positions in the government. Of course, they're not getting it, and that's a large reason for these strikes. So the talk of this, you know, the fact that it is looking like clear moves are being made to lay the groundwork so that a strike against Iran could take place against this backdrop in Iraq. But I think that these people feel, people in the Bush administration feel, that this is their go time, and that, look, they have X number of months left in power. We have nothing to lose if we're going to really try to consolidate power in the Middle East and have something akin to a regime change in Iran. That time is now.
Dar Jamil, we have about three-quarters of a minute left. What should the American people be saying to their elected representatives at this moment?
I think at this moment, I don't know how much clearer it needs to be for people to be ringing phones, going into the offices physically would probably be the best bet in demanding, what are you doing about this? Are you going to allow this? Do you agree?
But isn't there already an executive order in place that authorizes Bush to do this?
Well, there is, unfortunately, and I think the last thing the Congress has is once again to start cutting funding for the Iraq War and military funding, and perhaps that's something people should be demanding that the representatives
or pass a law that he cannot attack Iran without permission.
I would certainly be behind that as well.
Yeah, that would be a good start. We'll see. I was going to say I don't see it coming any day soon, but you never know. Okay, every now and then Congress surprises you. Dar Jamil, one of the real geniuses on these topics and the author of an absolutely brilliant book. If you don't have it, get it, Beyond the Green Zone. His website, Dar Jamil Iraq, DarJamilIraq.com. Dar Jamil, thanks for being with us, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. Well, I watched the world come to the
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right in these United States, not a privilege. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, great to talk to you. Listen, for those hundreds of listeners who haven't read Dar Jamal's book, Beyond the Green Zone, they absolutely have to pick it up. If they're wondering why he was so emphatic that there will be a bloodbath in Iraq, you got to read that book, because so much of his reporting was suppressed by media, like the innocent men, women, and children in Fallujah who were fired upon by U.S. troops just for walking into the street, you know, the breaking up of nonviolent demonstrations, all kinds of things, banning labor unions, and, I mean, just, you know, not to mention all the busting into people's homes and you know, taking the men away in their pajamas in front of their family members. We have torn that country apart, and if we wage war on their neighbor that now they're allied with, it's going to be Armageddon.
Yeah, well, and there are some guys on the religious right in particular who think Armageddon would be just a wonderful thing. Thank you very much. It'll bring Jesus back and usher in 1,000 years of peace.
Well, but it's important that those of us who are sane and don't believe that crazy stuff call our legislators, like you said, go to their office and say, we cannot drop nuclear bombs on a foreign country. We have to pass a law that will prevent this from happening.
I absolutely agree. I think that the invasion of Iraq was it was Bush's equivalent of the German invasion of Poland in, what was it, 39, I believe, and that this is what was next, the Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia,
and then Austria,
which is when it just, you know, when the whole thing. It's been too many years since I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. But,
I'd love to ask you if you could link to Dar Jamal's site from your website.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you might forget how to spell it. And Dar Jamal Iraq.net is the place to go.
Yeah.
He has the most up-to-minute reporting from reporters in Iraq.
It's .net. I have .com written down.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. Yeah, DarJamalIraq.com. Yeah, I mean, there's no censorship. Media types pulling out all the most useful information or burying it in the last sentence.
Yeah.
So it's the real deal.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jeff. Dar was on when his book first came out, and we talked about his book, and it really and truly is brilliant and horrifying reading. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Wes in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Wes.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. Step by step.
Earlier this morning, I heard an interview with Jonathan Steele, the fellow that you mentioned has written an article. Apparently, he's written a book along the same line. And in his interview, he was saying how the United States under Dick Cheney and et al. Are very heavy-handed and don't understand the subtleties of counterinsurgency, and just as Jeff mentioned before, the humiliation of the household heads.
Right, they think that you can beat people into loving you.
Yes, that's right. And made a quote from a captain he talked to, a U.S. military captain, a young guy in Iraq. He was embedded out on the front lines, and the captain said, it's much like starting a marriage with a rape.
That's a horrific but I think accurate metaphor. Wes, thanks a lot for that. Liz in Valley Glen, California, listening to us on K-Talk. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Tom. Since we went into Iraq for allegedly weapons of mass destruction, which I never believed, because ever since I heard that Iraq had the second largest reserve of oil, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yes, as our good friend Mr. Cheney is fond of
reminding us. Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, there you go.
And shouldn't we be getting, and since it's our tax dollars and our soldiers that are dying for all this oil, shouldn't we be getting the gasoline for free?
Yeah. Right. The fact of the matter is they are pumping oil. I think they're around 1.78 million barrels a day right now, and it was, I think, at its peak before the war, or perhaps before the 91 war, I'm not sure which one, around 2 million barrels. So that seems to be the capacity of their infrastructure.
or the old capacity of their infrastructure. But, yeah, where's our free gas in the Iraq war? A good question, Liz. I know that it's asked tongue in cheek, but it really highlights the tragedy of the whole thing. And I thank you for the call and for making it. It's, amazing. So back to politics. Monica, New York, you wanna talk about Hillary?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry to go back to your previous conversation, but I just have to tell you, I've been listening to you since you started on Air America, and I have always loved how fair-minded you were. I listen to everybody on Air America. But in particular, you alone invite people with opposing points of view, and you interact with them. So I've always given you profound credit for that. I have to say, though, I feel that this message is so distorted right now with regard to Hillary, and
right.
I feel that you are guilty.
Monica, may I ask you to hold on for a minute, please?
Sure.
Thank you. It's we had a break coming there at the bottom of the hour, and I'm sorry every now and then you miss those things, and I thought I had a minute more than I did. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Strange stuff, as they say in the news. This an actual story. A cornflake shaped like the state of Illinois has been sold by two sisters in Virginia for $1,350 on eBay. Believe it or not, it's not just people who want cornflakes shaped like Jesus or Elvis. It's the state of Illinois. Who would have known? Ah, me. Anyhow, Monica, we were talking a moment ago, and I you're saying that I'm sounding very anti-Hillary, and I have on a number of occasions in the past said I think, and I continue to think that Hillary Clinton has the potential to be the next Franklin Roosevelt, that she could rise to that. But in this campaign, I mean, just today, it just came out that she's revived, I guess, this whole Reverend Wright thing. She says, he would not have been my pastor. You don't choose your family, but you choose what church you want to attend. My ears perk up when Limbaugh endorses a Democrat, and he has endorsed her. I was very disappointed yesterday when an Obama surrogate mentioned the blue dress, but that was Obama saying that. This is Hillary Clinton now attacking Obama's minister. I just think that this thing, you know, I've been calling on both of these candidates to hold these campaigns to a high standard and to give us a reason to vote for them, not a reason to vote against the other guy. And I'm seeing that more often than not coming out of the Obama campaign. I'm seeing that less and less frequently coming out of the Clinton campaign. And I think I'm just calling it like I see it. I think either one of them would make a great president.
I would like to say that I don't think that's completely fair. I do agree that you have frequently said you would endorse whoever won, et cetera. However, I think that the Obama campaign actually has run very negative, but in a more one removed method. His surrogates have been really nasty against Hillary. But I completely agree with you. Both campaigns really need to elevate the conversation.
Yeah,
and the media is fanning the flames. And I think that, and I hate to say it, but I think Air America is participating in it. I think that we harp on the negative things rather than listening to you all discuss the differences between their health plans. What are the differences? What are their approaches, and why does it matter to us, and what give us more reason to be an informed voter rather than getting into this drama and popularity contest?
All right.
I mean, I think it's ugly.
I don't disagree with you. Pardon?
I'd like to ask you one question about
sure.
the convention system.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me to be a rather flawed system, the whole delegate process, and I think it's something that the last three major elections have shown us we really need to revisit. But isn't it originally designed that the point of the convention was to pick a candidate?
Yeah, it used to be that they would get together at the convention, but this was pre-television.
True, but we have not changed the system to update it to television. And frankly, I think it's actually very exciting that this race is so close and that states that have never participated are actually having a real voice.
I agree with you.
And
Here in Oregon, we vote on May 20th. I'm going to have an opportunity to vote in the primary.
Minnesota, I mean, people vote very late, and I think it's important that every state participates in this process.
Yeah.
I also think we keep forgetting when we're talking about the superdelegates that even the pledged delegates can vote however they want to at the convention. And
that's right.
I guarantee you on both sides, there are people that maybe voted 2 months ago that might vote differently today.
Yeah.
On both sides.
I understand and I agree, and I absolutely agree with you, Monica. And let me just add one, you know, correct or whatever. You said, you know, the system hasn't been updated. It was in the 80s that everybody got it, that the conventions were an opportunity to have literally hundreds of millions of dollars if it was bought by the minute worth of free national television advertising, and that valuable media real estate shouldn't be used as it was back during, you know, in the 60s and 70s for, you know, to see delegations standing up saying the great state of Delaware votes 23 delegates for, you know, that kind of thing. And instead that it should be used for the surrogates and the candidates themselves getting out there and putting out the memes of the campaign and kicking off the campaign. And that's why in both cases, both Republican and Democratic, the systems were put together that envisioned the candidate being selected before the actual convention happened. And I don't think that, you know, anybody anticipated that it would be this tight or it would go this far. And that's why I'm suggesting that the superdelegates really need to vote in June. And
I love that suggestion.
You know, yeah, and however it shakes out, I'm there to support it. So Monica, I gotta move along, but thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Len in New York City. Hey Len, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I'm calling on the other side of the aisle here. My, you know, I named my daughter after Hillary Clinton back in 1993, but I'm totally disgusted with her at this point. And my first question is, where the hell is John Edwards? He's the guy who kept going, we need a new kind of politics. We've got to stop doing things the way we always did. I mean, this lying is just another example of how Hillary is just willing to say and do anything.
Well,
and,
you know, you're talking about her Bosnia thing. I'm willing to cut her a lot of slack on that.
You know,
by the time you get to be, you know, her age and my age, I mean, she's a little older than I am, but, you know, memory is such a fungible, it's such a funky thing, you know.
Can I remind you how in 2006 she threw John Kerry under a bus? Okay, when he made that stupid joke about being dumb and ending up in Iraq, meaning George Bush,
right.
And you know, everyone took it as he was talking about the troops.
Right.
Every Democrat recognized that he was the worst joke teller.
Right.
Every Republican was jumping on it. Hillary Clinton stood there stone-faced and said his remarks were inappropriate. She was worried about running against him in 2008 and just threw him under a bus. And she's willing to throw anyone under a bus. And the reason she's not going to make a good president is because in a similar vein, not exactly the same as George Bush, in a similar vein, she's going to be in a position where force seems like a logical option to someone who wants to show that they're tough. And she's not necessarily someone whose judgment I trust as to when and when not to use force.
I got it, Len. I got it. And you know, thanks for sharing. And I had forgotten about the Kerry incident, but, you know, like, this is politics. This is hardball politics. I mean, these people are playing for very, very, very high stakes. I would just, you know, if it's going to get nasty, let the surrogates deal with it. I don't think that the candidates themselves should stoop to that level, or their spouses, frankly, on either side. Jerry in Nebraska. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on? I would like to say that one of your earlier callers was blaming Barack for the Michigan delegates, you know, saying that he didn't want it to happen or anything, but what she failed to realize that the DNC has sent out papers to all of them and told them if they move their primaries up, their delegates wasn't going to count.
Yeah, if you have a problem with it, you should discuss it with Congressman John Dingell and his wife, who were the lead advocates for Michigan, just saying to, you know, trying to play chicken with the DNC and force them to blink. But yeah, your point is well taken, Jerry, and well made. Julie in Seattle. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Tom. I believe that, and I thank you for this, that your discussion
and highlighting of the news items from the Middle East have brought us to a point, and here at the nearing the end of your show today, that where the 5% doctrine that David Brooks mentioned really comes to meet the Dick Cheney 1% doctrine. Democrats at this point need to put aside their imagined or real feelings about how they've been treated fairly or unfairly in the election process, and realize that if we do not unite behind a position and probably a candidate to oppose the rush to war in Iran, millions of people, Americans and other people, are about to die.
Yeah.
And
I agree. And that's why I've been calling all along, and I hopefully I'm doing this on this program, to say let's unite behind both of these candidates. Let people make their nuanced or unnuanced, whatever, decisions between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But let's do it in a positive, forward-looking fashion. And
well,
the fact that Saudi Arabia, the day after Dick Cheney visits them, is publishing in their newspaper, get ready for nuclear fallout, because because the U.S. is planning on dropping nuclear bombs in Iran, should scare the hell out of all of us. And we should be able to say, okay, you know, who cares about, you know, crazy pastors or blue dresses? There's real stuff going on here.
Well, Mrs. Clinton proposed several months ago, when her chances were closer to 50%, that she and Senator Obama agreed that a resolution should be proposed and passed to deny Bush the opportunity to make that kind of a preemptive strike. Now, the question I have for you is, at this point, how does Senator Clinton retrieve that high ground and get herself out of the corner she's painted herself into, where indicating that
McCain is
commander-in-chief and has good judgment, et cetera, and he's obviously going to be on board for this war effort? How do our two candidates come together?
The way that she reclaims the high ground is she begins attacking John McCain rather than Barack Obama. And Barack Obama's campaign needs to begin attacking John McCain. And if both of these, and not just John McCain, but the whole lineage all the way back to Ronald Reagan that has destroyed the New Deal, that we've got Hoovervilles now in the United States, you've got people living in parks and things who were living in homes just months ago. I mean, destructive Republican, from the war machine to the economy to the rich getting richer. Both of these candidates need to be going after John McCain, and here's the perfect opportunity for it. And instead, I see them fighting each other.
How can that dialogue be shifted so long as one of those candidates is promoting the Republican as a better option than one of our candidates?
Well, that's where I would suggest that you contact the Clinton campaign and say, please stop saying nice things about John McCain. I mean, That's one of the things that, frankly, bothers me. But, Julie, your point is well taken. Thank you very much. And I would hope that the Clinton campaign would begin to attack McCain. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I ain't live forever. I've lived enough, and I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Well, let me introduce to you a person who is one of my heroes and one of my friends. Helen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, one of the more extraordinary people that I know, and was honored to travel to Africa with to South Sudan and Darfur with a couple of weeks ago. Hey, Helen.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for the introduction. I don't know what to say. It's very complimentary. Lots going on, even though Congress is out of session. There has been the Social Security, Medicare, trust fund report released today, and there is not actually a change. Of course, the trust fund people change with the administration, so you pretty much have Republicans running that show, and now they're saying it's still insolvent. They didn't really change the date from last year of which it would become insolvent. Social Security trust fund by 2041, Medicare trust fund by 2019, as you have stated many times. We could fix Social Security by upping that
amount.
By just eliminating the cap. And in fact, the trust fund was designed to go away. Social Security was always pay-as-you-go before the Greenspan Commission in 82 or 83. And then they created this trust fund where the baby boomers would be the one and only generation in the history of the Social Security, where not only did you and I, Alan, pay for our parents' retirement, like our parents paid for their grandparents' retirement in, you know, actual, as they pay every year, that's the money that's going out of Social Security. But they would also, the baby boomers would also be setting aside money for their own retirement. So boomers are the only generation that are paying both for their parents' retirement and their own retirement. And the assumption was that by the 2030s or 2040s, most of the boomers would be dead and there would be no need for the trust fund and Social Security would go back to a pay-as-you-go system. And it probably will, and it would probably work just fine. The only problem being, of course, this cap of $100,000.
Exactly. And so you understand this better than anybody I know. So they've issued the report. Obviously, nothing's going to change on that front.
Yeah.
Several other things. One is that there were these four non-nuke nose cones that were shipped to Taiwan. And apparently they are called proximity fuses for missiles. They were supposed to be helicopter batteries, but somebody shipped the wrong package. And the United States, not wanting to upset China, notified them immediately. These were recovered, but people are saying this is another incident of some incompetency going on.
Is this a matter of, you know, they ordered part number 103442? -7 and they shipped part 10422-6 instead?
I don't know what the dashes were, but they did ship the wrong parts.
Yeah.
And of course, we're not sure why or what who did it and why, but of course,
yeah.
Now they're calling for a full investigation, etc.
Well, it seems like a reasonable thing to do, to investigate it, I mean.
Exactly. Now, a few other interesting things. There was a passenger rights law that a lot of us who travel on airplanes think is important. And New York State had a very tough law mandating certain rights for stranded airline passengers, but the federal appeals court said, only the federal government can regulate the airline industry.
Yeah, well, again, because they're constantly moving interstate, I guess that makes a certain amount of sense. Ellen, I'm curious. The German press, the DPA, one of the German press agencies, the larger German press agencies, is quoting the largest Saudi newspaper as running an article on Saturday, the day after Dick Cheney was in Saudi Arabia. Excuse me. As saying that Saudi Arabia is now preparing for nuclear fallout. Literally, nuclear fallout, radiation fallout from as a consequence of a U.S. nuclear strike on Iranian nuclear facilities, and that they were the Saudi governing council was going into session on Sunday to discuss how the kingdom can prepare for such a contingency. This is the day after Cheney was there. Is that story getting any legs in Washington?
Well, first of all, 90% of Washington, with the exception of the president, are not in town. 99%. I mean, I guess the Supreme Court is in town, and the president is in town. But basically, that's it. So it's very hard to get a sense of where the legs are on a story like that in terms of people talking about it. And a lot of the press is actually traveling either with the candidates or back or whatever. So Washington is a little bit of a ghost town right now.
Yeah.
It's really hard to gauge.
You have great contacts in the Middle East too. Are you hearing any kind of buzz from the Middle East about concern?
Not yet heard any buzz, but I got to tell you, if I was in Dubai, which would be straight in the path of that, which I will be for quite a few weeks over the next 6 months.
Yeah.
I think people would be very spooked out about it.
Yeah.
Now, remember, the president met today with the king of Bahrain, and the White House is saying that they discussed security issues, they discussed terrorism, they discussed all kinds of issues. And then this is sort of the public. And then, of course, the president went up, and they also discussed energy issues. Now, again, remember, Halliburton moved to Dubai,
Right. Bahrain is now trying to open up for more American and European business. And obviously, energy issues are very important.
Right. So we find parts of the Middle East trying to participate in you know, buying a chunk of America, at least, probably in a benign way. And at the same time, rumors that Cheney is getting ready to nuke Iran. I mean, it's totally bizarre, the polarity.
Yeah. So this is going to be this will be something to follow.
Yes, we live in interesting times. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, Tara Ross and Terry Jeffrey of CNSNews.com. Should be interesting day. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get involved. Let your congressmen and women know what you're thinking. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.